And for me, what was really special is I could make a difference today, race it tomorrow, or even make a difference with the setup of the car and see it race, and you get this instant feedback. You've done a good job or a bad job. Instant. And that hooked me completely.
Welcome to the Your Data Driven Podcast. If you like this podcast, be sure to visit our website at yourdatadriven.com for more useful help and advice on setting up your race car, mastering data analysis, and driving faster. Welcome to episode 51. This show is a second part of a very special two-parter with Willem Tooke, former head of aerodynamics from Benetton, Ferrari, Sauber, and BAR Formula One teams. Be sure to listen to part one if you missed it. But without further ado, let's carry on from where we left off last time. Grab a pen, grab a coffee, sit back, and let's enjoy what else William has to say.
And I suppose that's where the really question came in, really, because I suppose there's so many things you could do, and I guess... as a hierarchy of things, where to start with, you know, what's going to be the most efficient. Yep. I think that's where he was getting at. It's like, well, where do I start?
Yeah.
You know, that's fascinating. It's to have that kind of that I'm all about the data, and it's about quantifying some of the this intuition, because intuition, like, yep. It's out, but that's amazing how much of a difference that makes on the suspension. So
now, if you're generating downforce with a wing and you want the maximum you can get, if you want very efficient downforce, you still want your tufts to be everywhere relatively smooth. But if you're starting to approach the maximum, then probably the last 20% of your, let's say, rear wing element actually should be separated and should be very turbulent to get the very maximum power from a rear wing.
Oh.
So if you plaster a rear wing with tufts, your main plane should be fine. Your flap can afford then to have, say, the last 20% with quite a lot of turbulence. That's absolutely fine. But that's a deep knowledge of aerodynamics needs to tell you that you can't, that's not intuitive at all.
No. Yeah. I guess, yeah, you do need, I suppose, the measurement off the other side to see that.
And, yeah, the forces.
Yeah, was that stumbled across by accident by any chance? Because
No. It's if you study wing theory or you study wing profiles, there are certain laws of physics that were understood in Germany and in America in particular, but the Americans invented a series of profiles called NACA profiles, and they went through and did wind tunnel testing with a series of profiles, neutral and cambered. So a neutral profile is the same top and bottom. A cambered profile is like the same, if you imagine a teardrop shape, and then you bend it.
Yeah.
So that you end up with, instead of having a neutral profile, you have a cambered profile.
Understood.
So that would be, just take a neutral profile, nice rounded leading edge, tapering down, and then you bend it.
Clear.
That has camber. And when you do wind tunnel experiments, you learn that for all neutral elements, the amount of downforce they generate is directly linked to the angle of attack. Directly linked. There is a direct link. And what the shape of the aerofoil is actually doesn't matter. It's almost irrelevant, apart from skin friction. Isn't that weird? That is not normal. Yeah.
I'm sponging this information out there. I'm like, what? Because everything I've known so far is that there's so much goes into the profile of these wings, but
there is.
Is that sort of an optimization of the skin friction and trying to minimize that part of it rather than the actual.
And then if you have a cambered wing,
so
there is this linear relationship between angle and power.
Wow. Okay.
And that is relative to the onset flow.
Yeah.
Which may not be horizontal. If it's on a car, it will not be horizontal.
Well, that's the other assumption, isn't it?
That's another. And then the next thing that happens is if you have a cambered section, then a cambered section like this, horizontal, will produce, in this orientation, will produce downward force. I'm sort of 0 degrees, And so it doesn't matter whether it's flowing from left or right or right to left, it'll produce some downforce. Yeah. And then if it's coming from this side, if the air is coming from this side, there'll be an angle of attack where you produce zero downforce, maybe something like this. And then from that angle where you produce zero downforce, you start to change the angle and you go to exactly the same amount of downforce per unit angle as you get with a neutral section at an angle. You just have an offset of the angle.
Got it.
So a cambered section produces more downforce than a neutral section. Cool. Hey.
It's brilliant. So have you I've got a question for you about the education side of things for you, because you mentioned that a couple of times. So did you find that almost an advantage, or did you turn it into an advantage of the fact that you're kind of learning on the job, in effect? And so to satisfy yourself, you had to make it, visualize it, or did you sort of study, go off and do some studying and sort of catch up a bit with your peers, or I don't know, how did you cope with that?
So if I could give my younger self good advice, it would be go back and study the theory a bit more often, mate. But my attitude meant I developed, if you like, a deep physical understanding for what was going on, even though I didn't have the theory. And when I've now gone back and studied the theory in order to teach it. Unfortunately, it depends on your perspective and your attitude to your own education. But for some people, needing to know the mathematics to study aerodynamics is a disadvantage. And I believe in aerodynamics, if you want to solve the most difficult problems you have, you need a number of people with great theoretical skills, but you also need a number of people with, if you like, the intuition. No, that's maybe the wrong word. The artistic ability to just jump into different areas. You know, how do you use theory to tell you when I want to add a new element to this vehicle to make it improve? How do you know how to do that?
Yeah.
That's quite... Now,
there's a creative part to it there, I suppose.
There is a creative side. For sure, there's a creative side.
So Oppenheimer comes to mind. I don't know if you've seen the film, but yeah, he had this... the guy.
I haven't yet, but yeah.
Well, so the story, it's not going to spoil it for you, but he wasn't very good at algebra, but he was quite good at imagining what was going on in the atoms and such like, better than the people who could do the algebra. He just can prove it. So as a team, they all sort of play to their strengths, as it were, and the guys who could do them
and so
proved it.
In my career, I'd say that lack of theoretical background understanding of aerodynamics has been both an advantage and a disadvantage. My practical experimenting side was an advantage, especially in early days, where honestly, when we were starting, you didn't need to know aerodynamics when I was starting aerodynamics. You needed to know rate of change of shape versus rate of change of performance. And you just keep going until you've gone too far and you come back a bit. And then you move to the next element.
Yeah.
And then I was really quick at, as soon as someone else had an idea, I was very quick at trying to imagine, what the hell is that doing? What on earth is that doing? And so examples were barge boards invented by McLaren. They tested it before they went racing. By the time they got to the first race with their new idea, barge boards, Benetton had them.
Who have you worked for? So just for the sake, just as rolling, we haven't got that far yet, but like we might as well, do it now. So just for the people listening, you have spent a bit of time in Formula One.
32 years of age when I got my first Formula One job. That was 1985. And it was with the Tolman Group. Tolman Group were bought by Benetton, first sponsored by them, bought by Benetton. So that became Benetton. From there, we won the world championship, won the first world championship. We designed I'd worked on the design of the second world championship car, and then got poached and went to Ferrari. Went to Ferrari, built their new wind tunnel that they still use. They had a really small one in Maranello, built a state-of-the-art wind tunnel, and left to go to BAR, even before Honda, but BAR. In life, you make decisions. If you know it's a life-changing decision, it's an easy decision for me to make if I know it's life-changing. Because you consider it, well, some life-changing decisions you knowingly make are good ones. Some. Anyway, BAR Honda. And then from there, I went to BMW Sauber. Now, in the Benetton time, I took a little break. And at Benetton, Flavio Briatore took on John Barnard. I was loyal to Rory Byrne, who was the chief designer. He was still in charge. He was effectively technical director, but we didn't have anyone called a technical director. And so a whole bunch of us left Benetton, designed our own car that was aimed at, was intended to be a Reynard Formula One car. But I was a member of the board, along with people like Pat Simmons and Rory Byrne and Adrian Reynard. We were the board. We couldn't secure a factory engineer. We couldn't secure a title sponsor. And so we just agreed to fold the company. And then Rory Byrne, to his credit, rather than get a job for Rory Byrne, he went hunting for a job for his whole team. We went, all of us, back to Benetton. And Barnard was asked to. And Flavio learned a lot from that too.
A good friend of mine just wrote a book on that Benetton story, which I got for Christmas. I'm halfway through it, so I've got that far into the story.
Well, he hasn't spoken to me, so he's missing some bits. But anyway, that
have you read
matter.
It? Have you read it?
No, I haven't read it.
It's very large, very
I
much.
Will,
so.
I will read it, because for me it was really interesting. Rory would ask, how much budget do we have? And he would look to the best way to spend it. Barnard would think, gather information, how much do we need? He would add a zero on the end, stomp his feet and demand that. And when he only got half of it, he had five times what he needed to do a great job and every excuse in the book. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
That is brilliant.
Now, that's an exaggerated, potted philosophy, but there were quite different philosophies between different designers. They're different experts.
Yeah.
And they're good life lessons too, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. Wouldn't it be great to get just that little bit more grip from your tyres? To have complete confidence that you're setting the ideal tyre pressures for your car, your driving style, the track you're on, even the session type you're competing in. And what if you knew exactly what to do, no matter what the weather threw at you? Join the hundreds of pro and am drivers and engineers who've taken the Master Your Tyres program. Become my test driver in training, follow my step-by-step guides, and learn how to apply the included pro-grade smart run sheet. You will discover how to design practical experiments that will help you to precisely set up your tyres every single time. You can finally fill in the blanks and develop a more complete mental model of tyre mechanics. What makes them happy, what doesn't, all in bite-sized video lessons and presented from the driver's perspective. Visit tyrecourse.com to learn more about how to get more grip and more performance from the only part of your car that touches the racetrack. So sorry, I did jump in there on that one, but I just thought it'd be interesting for people to know a bit more your history there. But
So
you put the board straight onto the Benetton at that point. Having seen them on the McLaren, like the barge boards were on there, but I guess you didn't put them on there without understanding how they work. But it worked.
No, it was, we had a wind tunnel program, got a fax with a conceptual shape, looked around for some material we could use to put on the model, found a bit of aluminium, cut something out, bent it round an oxyacetylene tube, a cylinder to get the rough shape we wanted, made a few aluminium brackets. By the second run in the wind tunnel, it was better. We had worse cooling but better performance. By the time we'd spent a day and a half, we were 5% more downforce. It was like, wow, these things look like they send air away from the floor of the car, and they actually send more floor air in. And then that was when you get the wool tuft and you have a look, what the heck is going on? They look in plan view like they're deflecting air away, yet the pressure sensors on the floor say, I'm getting more air to the floor. And what happens is you roll a vortex up that takes air that's coming along beside the barge boards and pushes that air down and underneath.
This is the clever bit. That's when my mind just goes a little bit crazy, because you're trying to get the air into a tunnel, in effect, and that sort of energizes it. And that's basically all I know. It's just literally like, Okay, that's a bit 3D. That's getting quite clever for me now.
Yeah. So I do have a couple of posts on motorsport.com's YouTube channel about front wings and the Y250 Vortex.
That's it, yeah. Yeah, the YT.
And
this one, isn't it?
That's where I tried to explain a little bit, and it comes down to air can't go through a solid object, and so it tries to find its own... it's not correct to say that it's using intelligence, but it can't go through an object. It's forced to take another path, and that creates these vortices that then can be used. And when you see a vortex core, say, from a rear wing, or you used to be able to see the Y250 Vortex, but certainly even today, well, today they've also, with the rounded rear wing end plates, they've tried to get rid of the tip vortex off a wing as well. But you would sometimes see that. But that vortex, that's the core you see. And what you actually see is you see humidity in air being condensed into droplets that are big enough that you can actually see them. And so that's just changing pressures caused the water, the humidity to just condense into tiny droplets. That's why you see it. But that vortex is much bigger than the core you can see. So you start imagining, okay, you see this little core, but what happens to the air that's out here? It's being rotated more slowly, but it's also being rotated. And the Y250 Vortex would take air that would normally just pass above the front wing, and it would rotate it inward and downward, and then downward and outward, but it would rotate it inward and downward enough that it would actually go underneath the floor of the car. And you ram a load of extra air under the floor of the car. Very cool.
That is, yeah. I mean, just thinking that through, but that, yeah. So I've only seen the little ones, but yeah. So you're,
yeah.
It's the whole body, the whole mass of air, I suppose, is all
ripping. Yeah. It's being rotated. So being, if you just imagine, if you take a small amount of air and you swirl that, it's going to have an influence on the parcels of air near that and will create slower. And so that's what happens. You get those interactions. Air is incredibly interactive.
So I suppose that I've got one little question here for you, so I'm a suspension guy, if anything. And when the new rules came out in Formula One with the underfloor requirements, the Red Bull came out with what I thought was quite an interesting front suspension with quite a lot of what looks like anti-dive on it. And I was trying to work out why they would do that, because yet again dynamics is compromised, I think, for aerodynamics. But all I could figure out was they were trying to hold or control the front of that floor in a particular way. So it's almost like you move the pitch center of the car a little bit and make it stiffer, so for different ride heights you could, the virtual stiffness of that point on the car doesn't really change. So you can do all sorts of things, but that point isn't going to really move. And I just wondered whether that was a thing, or whether I'd made that up, or whether that was important, that front of the floor edge, or whether it's the back and the stuff that's coming from the back.
It's both.
Coming through. I don't know.
It's both. The design that the rulemakers came up with, now they had limited resources to design a completely new set of aerodynamic regulations, which is really tough. And then every team had more than 10 times that resource to try and find a way around it. Yeah. But they had limited resource trying to develop this set of regulations. And they developed regulations that were actually quite sensitive to height, front and rear.
Oh.
And so if you can stabilize the front, you have a more stable aero platform. There's a lot more to it than that.
I imagine.
Now, I want to pop back to using resources. So with my lifetime experience, I got a job at the Sauber Group, and I've worked for the Sauber Group three times. Been fired twice, but I've been hired three times. Long story, but in a senior position in a company that's not doing particularly well, and in Sauber's case it was BMW withdrew. That was the first time. They needed to reduce the size of the company so that Peter Sauber could buy it back and not have a salary bill that was simply going to drain his entire fortune in the first year. And so BMW had to cut it down. And I was actually really grateful to be made redundant. Officially, they call it made redundant. I was really grateful to be made redundant when I'm being asked in one afternoon to tell more than half my department they're redundant. You have a department, let's say, in round numbers, 100 people, and to run a Formula One team, you need to build the car and run the car. What can you cut out? You cut out what you feel is the luxury, which is the research. Now, the research is what gives you the performance.
Of course.
But if you can't afford to pay your salaries, you've got to do something and you've got to get the car to the grid every race. So Peter was left with few choices. And so I was very grateful, to be honest, when I'm telling half my department, and I couldn't even give them the dignity of telling them one-to-one. There was not the time. So you have to have groups, and you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out. And there's no time to explain. You've got what the a lunchtime meeting. I'm really sorry to say, we're really happy to say the company's going to be saved. Peter Sauber's buying it back, but there are going to be extensive redundancies. And when I'm telling half my family, because they're like my family, that I'm just about to make their lives hell,
yeah.
It's quite nice that I'm also in a position where I don't have somewhere to go to. I also have to look. Yeah. And then 18 months later, they called me back. And then Sauber went through a long period of very little funding. And Monisha Kaltenborn was running the company. She did an amazing job of keeping it just alive, just surviving, just. But eventually, you have to blame someone for the performance. And eventually, after a couple of technical directors and chief designers and head of vehicle performance, eventually head of aero had to be on the list. So it was my turn. And then I now work for them a little bit as a consultant. And to be honest, Formula One, I'm now over 70. Formula One, to do it well, I would only do it if I did it well. To do it well, I don't believe you can do that job, let's say, in part-time-ish capacity. And I relish the idea of passing on knowledge. But I will now come back to Formula One access. So wind tunnel testing, I started 1 week in, 3 weeks out. You eventually get to, eventually you build your own wind tunnel. You start to do full-time occupation of the wind tunnel, then full-time two shifts, then full-time three shifts. Then you start thinking, okay, 24/7. Now I resisted at the point of 24/7. But I worked all my life about just making it more efficient. And so I would work on how much time do we need at each attitude? Can we go to continuous motion and acquisition? How can I speed up the time between pressing the go button and the wind speed and the road speed being on target?
So I actually remember years ago, I listened to a talk of yours a couple of years ago, maybe a couple more than a couple, and it was when the limits had come in on the wind tunnel. And you said, yeah, so, well, the wind tunnel typically starts in a really consistent way. So it takes a little while to get up to speed with the wind. So how can we use that startup time? And with a bit of maths, you can kind of, you know, work it out. And it was like,
yeah,
genius.
So a wind tunnel will be built with a closed loop control system to allow you to run to any speed, and you will approach the target speed, you'll inevitably overshoot. The wind tunnel is 25 meters away from where the working section is in terms of airline. So it takes a bit of time for it all to settle. And so you overshoot and then the speed sort of settles down. Yeah. And then the cooling system comes in and it's out of phase a little bit with the speed. But because we started in a consistent way, we saved more than 30 seconds. The first attempt, it wasn't me that did it, it was one of my geniuses, which was just given the task of looking at the problem and finding a way to shorten the time. We were doing 350 runs every week. Half a minute, just on building up the wind speed, half a minute, 350 times. Yeah, you've got 180 minutes extra. You got 3 hours, you say. Shit.
Boom. Yeah. You may know that at the end of Season 1, I wrote the Motorsports Playbook, a summary distilling the first 20 shows into nuggets of wisdom. I made the notes so that you don't have to. If you've not got it yet, go and grab yourself a copy from the website. And that's what I love about motorsport. I just love that. Yep. That thinking. I've done a bit of work, well, quite like a decade or so in Olympic sport, and one of the reasons
Ooh,
I was
there. Uh-huh.
Yes. Well, you know, try and help out a little bit. And my contribution to that world was helping them with the data and the numbers and stuff that they already have, but just sort of making it more efficient and visualizing what they were doing. But
yeah.
it wasn't until I sort of stepped out of what in effect we might take for granted into a different environment where they're still competing, but that wasn't ingrained in their mindset to sort of go, oh, actually, we could do this more efficiently by just doing that. Well, no, we'll just keep on turning the handle. That's my job.
Yeah.
And it was like, you don't have to do that, by the way. You could automate that bit. And they're like, oh.
So I would say I made a significant contribution to the fact that aero testing is restricted simply because people who left Sauber and went to other teams complained bitterly about how inefficient they were compared to what Sauber had. And other teams were scared of just how fast we were able to get stuff done. An alternative solution was Toyota, who went 24/7 with their wind tunnel and decided they needed more, so they built a second wind tunnel. The Sauber wind tunnel cost 55 million euros. The Mercedes wind tunnel cost 25 million pounds.
Wow.
I worked on efficiency. And I balked at 7 days a week. Most people on the planet have some religion that they believe in. And it doesn't, as a boss, it doesn't matter to me what people's religion is. It doesn't matter to me whether they are or are not religious, purely speaking as a boss. What matters to me is I get a job done and my people are stable and happy. I don't know anyone who's going to stay stable and happy when you make them work 7 days a week for a month, for example. You need time away.
Yeah.
And I reasoned, if I left Sundays aside and we had an emergency, you at least had a 24-hour period spare that could be used in an emergency to solve a problem. You have a breakage in the tunnel. But you've got deadlines to meet with releasing designs for manufacture and so on, then I just did not want to go 24/7. 24/6 I went for, and I worked hard on efficiency.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the payback was the rulemakers came in with the help of all the other teams who were scared of what we were achieving and slowed us down. And now you can do so few runs, it's ridiculous. But teams will take a ridiculous amount of time thinking about the results before they move to the next test because they now can.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a waste of a resource. But that, yeah. Now, I'm hoping that with a budget cap, we can eventually talk sense to the teams where they take away some of these restrictions. It'll take a long time on aero because aerodynamics is so powerful. So with aerodynamics, a Formula One car goes approximately, if you say, took away the downforce and then reduced the drag dramatically, let's say you reduced the drag to 30% of what it is today, you would probably go 22 or 23 seconds a lap slower than you do today on an average circuit.
Yeah.
It's huge. And that's why you make these terrible compromises for suspension and in the days up to 22, the really high rear center of gravity height with the high ride heights was clearly negative from a mechanical grip perspective or mechanical handling perspective, but it made such a difference to the low speed to high speed aerodynamic balance that you were better off that way.
Just get on with it. It's kind of like that. So I've got. I'm just looking at the time, conscious of the time and taking up too much of yours. Just wrapping up, just to sort of pull that together back into the world of, you know, the amateur paddock and thinking of all those, summing up all of those, that sort of resource and that creativity and thinking about approaching things in a different way. I can't ignore the aero now, obviously, because it's so powerful, but at the same time, There are restrictions in many series and what makes series and such like on purpose. But if you had one or two things that people were thinking about, or you were advising someone in the paddock and it's like, okay, well, you might want to try that kind of thing, or even the simple things, or just thinking through something different. I mean, have you got any final thoughts on
so your... I would say, yep, I do. One thing I would say, if you're into motorsport and you're thinking about aerodynamic modifications, perhaps go to a British hill climb championship round. I've been hill climbing in the UK for a long time, have given a great deal of advice to hill climbers, and they've used my advice, their own research, back-to-back testing, and discussions with other experts, and they have freedom of regulation that you maybe don't have in other categories. So if you look at the standard category, the standard formula categories, they are either made to a budget and you're not allowed to touch them,
yep,
or they are restricted very severely in what you can touch.
Yep.
You go to hill climbing and the aerodynamic regulations are freer, and British hill climb cars are very good aerodynamically, even on average. Everybody has asked questions. They've all been given the same honest advice. They've had different capabilities. They've then done their own research. They've used other experts as well. And so there's something to do there. Then a floor with diffuser can be fitted to almost any car if the rules allow. And it's going to be the most efficient thing you can do. I have some articles on LinkedIn and on Racetech magazine about how motorsport diffusers work. Either one will work. There's more information on Racetech magazine's website than there is on LinkedIn, but the LinkedIn post has better images initially and then has a link to the Racetech magazine article.
Well, if you're okay, I can link them in the show notes if you're happy about that.
Sure.
Brilliant.
Yeah. It's just how motorsport diffusers work. Willem Towett, a Google search will find them. But it's easy. And that's going to be the most efficient device. Then anything else needs a tiny bit more work and imagination. But I think looking at what other people have done and talking to them, the other thing I love about hill climbing is it's such a friendly sport.
Yeah.
You can go and ask the owner of a car what they did and why they did it and how much difference it made. You can ask and they'll talk to you. One ticket gets you everywhere. You can stand over the top of the cars and have a really good look. Yeah.
I mean, fortunate that people listen from all over the world, and there's a general culture, I think, in motorsport, I'm going to say on the positive side, that they're pretty open. I don't think people don't necessarily always tell you the truth, but if there's a gain to be had on that, tire pressures, for example, you may not get that out of people. But other things about... Yeah. How people have approached things or whatever. I think it's worth having those conversations, and you can kind of try and filter, you know, the answer. But then I think you made the main point there is that you go out and try and do it yourself and try, do some experiments, but with this in mind, it's like, okay, well, this is what should happen. Let's see that back to back.
So one of the people you spoke to recently is Julian Edgar.
Julian, yeah.
He's an Australian guy who is not an expert in any particular field of engineering, but he is a dyed-in-the-wool experimenter, very methodical about his experiments. He's written books about his experiments. He's got a couple of books out there about aerodynamics. I think they're amazing books because it shows how he can make gains with just one step at a time, literally one step at a time. Amazing documentation of all that work that he's done.
I agree.
He's a very
absolutely
determined human being.
Yes, he was very determined on the show, actually, as well. but very generous as well with his thoughts and what he shared. It was so practical. You just literally just like do this, yeah, guys, and go away and do it. It was a real pleasure, yeah, to have him on, and it's been an absolute, yeah, pleasure to have you on as well. I really thank you so much for taking the time. I knew this was going to be good. And look, I just want to say from me and from everyone listening, thank you very much.
A pleasure. Good to talk to you.
So what did you think of that? What an absolute privilege to get Willem on the show. The more I do this, the more I realise that people who have succeeded at the very top are often the most giving with their time and experience. I hope you got some good notes, ideas and things to try. Be sure to check out all those links in the show notes. Particularly, there's a video on the challenges and solutions that Willem faced while developing the Sauber wind tunnel. And frankly, I'm surprised he's allowed to share it in the public domain.
If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and visit us at yourdatadriven.com.